This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Dennis Smith's new book, A Decade of Hope, is about 9/11 first responders and the families whose loved ones were in the World Trade Center towers on September 11th. We're going to listen back to Terry's conversations with a couple of the firefighters profiled in A Decade of Hope. We'll begin with Ken Haskell. He's a New York City firefighter, as were his father and two brothers, Tommy and Timmy. The brothers died at Ground Zero on September 11th. That morning, Haskell was off duty, but when he heard the news, he headed to Ground Zero. When Terry recorded this interview with Ken Haskell last week, he couldn't make it to our radio studio. He was helping his mother fix up her home after Hurricane Irene, so he spoke with Terry by phone.
Did you know your brothers would be at the World Trade Center trying to rescue people?
Well, I'd assume my brother Timmy would most likely be there because he worked in Squad 18, which is in Lower Manhattan. But he had also lived in Lower Manhattan in the Tribeca area, so he was very close to the proximity of the Trade Center. So I had a big inclination that he would be there one way or the other. My brother Tommy was a captain who worked in Bedford-Stuyvesant. I wasn't sure if either were on duty that day, but I was less concerned about Tommy actually having to respond, you know, from such a distance. I didn't actually confirm that they were working until probably 1 or 2 o'clock that morning when I had ran into some people that responded or had seen them responding. And so it wasn't until about 2 in the morning that I actually found out they were there and they were missing.
When you got to Ground Zero, right after the towers collapsed, you first started trying to put out the fire in Building 7, and then you had an instinct that it was going to fall, so you walked away, and it did. It did fall. And then eventually what you took on as your work was looking for the remains of people who had been trapped in the towers. When you started doing that job, did you think that your brothers might be in those remains?
Well, obviously anybody who was there on the scene, you know, had the realization that there was going to be a tremendous amount of casualties. One thing that was striking, there really wasn't many remains left around the site. You know, the whole site had been reduced to basically anything that wasn't metal was reduced to ash, you know, or completely pulverized, you know, which was really a true testament to the energy that was created when those buildings fell, you know. So the likelihood of anybody surviving was minimal. And that was a realization that set in very quickly for me and gave me a lot of perspective about how I went about working the first couple of days, you know, the risks I was willing to take versus the reward that might be out there. You're always an optimist when you're working in situations like that. You're always hopeful that you're going to be able to help somebody, you know, perhaps save a life. So you're going to continue to work regardless of the circumstances that are in front of you. And unfortunately, on September 11th, there just wasn't too many survivors. And that was very apparent almost immediately for anybody that was working the site.
You know, you use the word rewards in terms of, like, finding remains, and it's such a topsy-turvy thing when finding, like, a body or an arm or a leg is the reward for your work. It's such a gruesome and tragic reward.
Well, as a professional firefighter, I had a responsibility to my department and to my job, but I also was dealing with the moral obligation I had to my family, particularly my brother Tommy's oldest daughter, Megan, who at the time was 9, who every chance she got, she asked if I was going to bring her father home, you know. And that really was difficult for me because I didn't want to make a promise to my niece that I knew I wouldn't be able to keep. But, you know, having said that, you still go to work every day and you're hopeful. And, you know, and I was in a unique position where knowing that I was looking for my two brothers in addition to doing all the other responsibilities that I had as a fireman during that time, when I did come across remains, I found myself analyzing what I was looking at, you know, as if I might know what my brother's FEMA might look like, because that's what I had in my hand, you know.
One of your brothers, Tommy, was never found, but the other, Timmy, his body was found pretty intact.
Right.
How do you think his body managed to remain intact? What kind of scenario did you create in your mind to explain that?
Well, you know, when Timmy was found, I was actually underneath the South Tower because I would actually alternate my time parts of the day, once between the North Tower and once between the South Tower, because I knew one of my brothers were in each. Now, the fact that we were able to recover him was because Timmy had gotten so high in the North Tower, from my understanding, was in the upper 30s, close to the 40th floor. My brother Tommy, I was able to find out that they were located near the lobby area of the South Tower at the time when it collapsed. So really there was no expectation of any kind of recovery for him or anybody else that was in that portion of the building, because just the radiant heat from all the fires and the compression and, you know, the energy that was created when the buildings collapsed just pulverized everything at that point.
Did it make a difference in how you and your brother's families and your mother grieved for them, the difference between having an attack body and having no remains at all?
Well, you know, even throughout Timmy's wake and his funeral, you know, the conversation...
Timmy's the brother whose body was
intact. My brother Timmy, yeah. You know, was found in the North Tower. We recovered him and we were able to have a funeral. But all throughout his wake and the funeral itself, there was hopeful talk amongst the families. You know, whether we were going to recover Tommy or not, we still held on to that possibility that perhaps we someday would. You know, as the weeks and months went by, it became obvious that wasn't going to happen. So in November of 2001, we decided to go ahead and have a memorial because we just felt that it was an appropriate thing to do. And rather than have a funeral, we had a memorial where a casket was actually there, and everybody was asked to bring something in relation to Tommy, or write a note, or put a picture in, or something that was meaningful to them, and which also meant something to my brother. And subsequently, we buried that casket next to Timmy.
Oh. So in December, you went back to work as a firefighter. And in the book, you describe your first fire after going back to work in a three-story frame house that was burning on the second and third floors. And you say that you felt really apprehensive. You had something like a clairvoyant moment telling you not to go in there. But you went in anyways. Would you describe what happened after you got in?
Well, my brother Tommy's daughters and his wife Barbara had always said that after Tommy was gone, they always felt his presence anytime they saw a ladybug. And anytime any of the girls had seen a ladybug, no matter where they were, they would always text me or call me and say, hey, you know, I saw a ladybug today, and I happened to be thinking of Dad at the time. So it kind of became a bit of symbolism for them, you know, the way they memorialized Tommy. And that particular fire, like you said, I did kind of have a moment of, like, clairvoyance where, you know, while it was a bad fire, it wasn't unique. It was, you know, I had been in similar situations before and helped fight the fire without incident, but there was something telling me not to go in there. And it's, you know, I went into the apartment real quick. I was able to get into one bedroom in the apartment real quick, and rather than go through the public hallway or make my way further into the apartment like I normally would have, I just decided to just go back to the ladder, went back down, was going to make my way around, find another way to get back in. And then part of the parapet, the front of the building collapsed, and took out the ladder I was on, and then the room I just left flashed over. So I went about fighting the rest of the fire, and afterwards I was sitting on a stoop across the street just having a drink of water, and I was kind of reflecting on what had happened. And as I went to raise a glass to my mouth to take a sip of the water, there was a ladybug on my hand. So I really think it really struck me, you know, in a way that I hadn't heard this story or had that relation with the ladybugs and the girls. I probably wouldn't have thought anything of it. I probably would have swatted the bug away, you know. But in that situation, it was like looked up to the sky and said hello to my brother and thanked him, you know.
So you felt like somehow your brother had kind of told you to get out of the building,
yeah,
right before your ladder burned and the parapet collapsed where you were.
Yeah.
Was there ever a part of you that thought you can't still be a firefighter? Because two of your brothers had died at the World Trade Center on 9/11. You were the only remaining son your mother had. You'd seen one of your brother's wives become a widow. Did you ever think, like, I really can't go back and do that because I have to make sure I don't die in the fire for the sake of my family?
You know, I had thought about that. I'm not so much concerned for myself, but for my wife and for my mother, obviously. But it was quite the opposite for me. I felt more of a responsibility to give to the department after my brothers were killed. I mean, it's how I was raised on the department. You know, it's the traditions that we have. You know, I always took that to heart. I felt a great responsibility. I love the job. It's provided, you know, a great career for me, and I felt the responsibility to stay on because we had lost so many guys, and I knew we'd be hiring a lot of young guys, and there would be, you know, a need for senior guys to help these guys, to show them the way. You know, I actually, after my brothers were killed, I actually transferred to a busier firehouse than the one I'd been working at the time. So not to say that, you know, I enjoy taking chances or I'm hooked on the danger. I mean, I do love the job still. I'm most happy when we're busy and when we're doing things. But it really came from a sense of respect for the job and almost a sense of obligation that I felt personally to give back in the way that Tommy and Timmy served and the other 341 firefighters that we lost within the FDNY. I mean, those guys are the true symbolism of heroism and commitment, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for the legacy that they left.
Well, Ken Haskell, I want to thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you. Nice talking to you, Terry, and take care.
New York City firefighter Ken Haskell is one of the people profiled in Dennis Smith's new book, A Decade of Hope. In a moment, we'll talk with Deputy Chief Jay Jonas of the New York Fire Department. He was on the fourth floor of the North Tower when the building collapsed and lived to tell the story. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Dennis Smith's new book, A Decade of Hope, is about 9/11 first responders and the families whose loved ones were in the World Trade Center towers on September 11th. We're going to listen back to Terry's conversations with a couple of the firefighters profiled in A Decade of Hope. We'll begin with Ken Haskell. He's a New York City firefighter, as were his father and two brothers, Tommy and Timmy. The brothers died at Ground Zero on September 11th. That morning, Haskell was off duty, but when he heard the news, he headed to Ground Zero. When Terry recorded this interview with Ken Haskell last week, he couldn't make it to our radio studio. He was helping his mother fix up her home after Hurricane Irene, so he spoke with Terry by phone.
Did you know your brothers would be at the World Trade Center trying to rescue people?
Well, I'd assume my brother Timmy would most likely be there because he worked in Squad 18, which is in Lower Manhattan. But he had also lived in Lower Manhattan in the Tribeca area, so he was very close to the proximity of the Trade Center. So I had a big inclination that he would be there one way or the other. My brother Tommy was a captain who worked in Bedford-Stuyvesant. I wasn't sure if either were on duty that day, but I was less concerned about Tommy actually having to respond, you know, from such a distance. I didn't actually confirm that they were working until probably 1 or 2 o'clock that morning when I had ran into some people that responded or had seen them responding. And so it wasn't until about 2 in the morning that I actually found out they were there and they were missing.
When you got to Ground Zero, right after the towers collapsed, you first started trying to put out the fire in Building 7, and then you had an instinct that it was going to fall, so you walked away, and it did. It did fall. And then eventually what you took on as your work was looking for the remains of people who had been trapped in the towers. When you started doing that job, did you think that your brothers might be in those remains?
Well, obviously anybody who was there on the scene, you know, had the realization that there was going to be a tremendous amount of casualties. One thing that was striking, there really wasn't many remains left around the site. You know, the whole site had been reduced to basically anything that wasn't metal was reduced to ash, you know, or completely pulverized, you know, which was really a true testament to the energy that was created when those buildings fell, you know. So the likelihood of anybody surviving was minimal. And that was a realization that set in very quickly for me and gave me a lot of perspective about how I went about working the first couple of days, you know, the risks I was willing to take versus the reward that might be out there. You're always an optimist when you're working in situations like that. You're always hopeful that you're going to be able to help somebody, you know, perhaps save a life. So you're going to continue to work regardless of the circumstances that are in front of you. And unfortunately, on September 11th, there just wasn't too many survivors. And that was very apparent almost immediately for anybody that was working the site.
You know, you use the word rewards in terms of, like, finding remains, and it's such a topsy-turvy thing when finding, like, a body or an arm or a leg is the reward for your work. It's such a gruesome and tragic reward.
Well, as a professional firefighter, I had a responsibility to my department and to my job, but I also was dealing with the moral obligation I had to my family, particularly my brother Tommy's oldest daughter, Megan, who at the time was 9, who every chance she got, she asked if I was going to bring her father home, you know. And that really was difficult for me because I didn't want to make a promise to my niece that I knew I wouldn't be able to keep. But, you know, having said that, you still go to work every day and you're hopeful. And, you know, and I was in a unique position where knowing that I was looking for my two brothers in addition to doing all the other responsibilities that I had as a fireman during that time. When I did come across remains, I found myself analyzing what I was looking at, you know, as if I might know what my brother's femur might look like, because that's what I had in my hand, you know.
One of your brothers, Tommy, was never found, but the other, Timmy, his body was found pretty intact.
Right.
How do you think his body managed to remain intact? What kind of scenario did you create in your mind to explain that?
Well, you know, when Timmy was found, I was actually underneath the South Tower because I would actually alternate my time parts of the day, once between the North Tower, once between the South Tower, because I knew one of my brothers were in each. Now, the fact that we were able to recover him was because Timmy had gotten so high in the North Tower, from my understanding, was in the upper 30s, close to the 40th floor. My brother Tommy, I was able to find out that they were located near the lobby area of the South Tower at the time when it collapsed. So really there was no expectation of any kind of recovery for him or anybody else that was in that portion of the building, because just the radiant heat from all the fires and the compression and, you know, the energy that was created when the buildings collapsed just pulverized everything at that point.
Did it make a difference in how you and your brother's families and your mother grieved for them, the difference between having an intact body and having no remains at all?
Well, you know, even throughout Timmy's wake and his funeral, you know, the conversation.
Timmy's the brother whose body was
my
intact.
Brother Timmy, yeah. You know, was found in the North Tower. We recovered him and we were able to have a funeral. But all throughout his wake and the funeral itself, there was hopeful talk amongst the families. Whether we were going to recover Tommy or not, we still held on to that possibility that perhaps we someday would. As the weeks and months went by, it became obvious that wasn't going to happen. So in November of 01, we decided to go ahead and have a memorial because we just felt that it was an appropriate thing to do. And rather than have a funeral, we had a memorial where a casket was actually there and everybody was asked to bring something in relation to Tommy, or write a note, or put a picture in, or something that was meaningful to them, and which also meant something to my brother. And subsequently, we buried that casket next to Timmy.
Oh. So in December, you went back to work as a firefighter. And in the book, you describe your first fire after going back to work in a 3-story frame house that was burning on the second and third floors. And you say that you felt really apprehensive. You had something like a clairvoyant moment telling you not to go in there. But you went in anyways. Would you describe what happened after you got in?
Well, my brother Tommy's daughters and his wife Barbara had always said that after Tommy was gone, they always felt his presence anytime they saw a ladybug. And anytime any of the girls had seen a ladybug, no matter where they were, they would always text me or call me and say, hey, you know, I saw a ladybug today, and I happened to be thinking of Dad at the time. So it kind of became a bit of symbolism for them, you know, the way they memorialized Tommy. And that particular fire, like you said, I did kind of have a moment of, like, clairvoyance where, while it was a bad fire, it wasn't unique. It was, you know, I had been in similar situations before and helped fight the fire without incident. But there was something telling me not to go in there, and it's, you know, I went into the apartment real quick. I was able to get into one bedroom in the apartment real quick. And rather than go through the public hallway or make my way further into the apartment like I normally would have, I just decided to just go back to the ladder. Went back down, was going to make my way around, find another way to get back in. And then part of the parapet, the front of the building collapsed, and took out the ladder I was on, and then the room I just left flashed over. So I went about fighting the rest of the fire, and afterwards I was sitting on a stoop across the street just having a drink of water, and I was kind of reflecting on what had happened. And as I went to raise a glass to my mouth to take a sip of the water, there was a ladybug on my hand. So I really think it really struck me, you know, in a way that I hadn't heard this story or had that relation with the ladybugs and the girls. I probably wouldn't have thought anything of it. I probably would have swatted the bug away, you know. But in that situation, it was like looked up to the sky and said hello to my brother and thanked him, you know.
So you felt like somehow your brother had kind of told you to get out of the building right before your ladder burned and the parapet collapsed where you were.
Yeah.
Was there ever a part of you that thought you can't still be a firefighter? Because two of your brothers had died at the World Trade Center on 9/11. You were the only remaining son your mother had. You'd seen one of your brother's wives become a widow. Did you ever think, like, I really can't go back and do that because I have to make sure I don't die in the fire for the sake of my family?
You know, I had thought about that. I'm not so much concerned for myself, but for my wife and for my mother, obviously. But it was quite the opposite for me. I felt more of a responsibility to give to the department after my brothers were killed. I mean, it's how I was raised on the department, you know, the traditions that we have, you know, I always took that to heart. I felt a great responsibility. I love the job. It's provided, you know, a great career for me. And I felt the responsibility to stay on because we had lost so many guys, and I knew we'd be hiring a lot of young guys, and there would be, you know, a need for senior guys to help these guys, to show them the way. You know, I actually, after my brothers were killed, I actually transferred to a busier firehouse than the one I'd been working at the time. So not to say that, you know, I enjoy taking chances or I'm hooked on the danger. I mean, I do love the job still. I'm most happy when we're busy and when we're doing things. But it really came from a sense of respect for the job and almost a sense of obligation that I felt personally to give back in the way that Tommy and Timmy served and the other 341 firefighters that we lost within the FDNY. I mean, those guys are the true symbolism of heroism and commitment, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for the legacy that they left.
Well, Ken Haskell, I want to thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you. Nice talking to you, Terry, and take care.
Deputy Chief Jay Jonas was a captain in the New York City Fire Department on September 11th. On a rescue mission, he led his men up the stairs of the World Trade Center's North Tower. When he heard the South Tower had collapsed, Jonas felt the North Tower's demise was imminent and decided to lead his men back down the stairs. But on their way down, they came across Josephine Harris, a woman who could barely walk. Jonas knew that rescuing Harris would slow them down and increase the chance they'd all die in the tower. But Jonas and his firefighters took Josephine Harris with them. They'd made it to the fourth floor when the tower fell. Jonas was trapped in the rubble, along with his firefighters and Josephine Harris.
Chief, you knew you were risking your men's lives and your own life to rescue Josephine Harris, and that the odds were you wouldn't save her either because she was so slow and the building was on the verge of collapse, and you were, what, on the 27th floor?
We were on the 27th floor when the South Tower collapsed. That was our big indicator for us to make our escape.
So how did you decide to stop for her, knowing it meant you would all be leaving very slowly, probably too slow to get out?
Well, it was a lot easier decision for the firefighters under my command, because they didn't really know that the South Tower had collapsed. I didn't know that till later. We experienced all kinds of earthquake-like rumbles. Our building swayed back and forth, and the lights went out for 30 seconds. And it wasn't really apparent what that was. And there was another captain on the 27th floor, Billy Burke, the captain of Engine 21. And I told Billy, you go check the south windows, I'll check the north windows, and we'll come back here. And I kind of felt that a piece of our building had just collapsed. That's why our building moved so violently. And he just looked at me and he said, the south tower had collapsed. And I didn't realize it, but my firefighters under my command didn't hear the conversation with Captain Burke and myself. And I just looked at them and said, okay, if that one can go, this one can go. It's time for us to get out of here. And they looked at me a little quizzically because they had just climbed 27 floors with 100 pounds of gear on their backs. And I said, let's go. It's time to retreat. And we're actually making pretty good time going down the stairs. And once we made it to the 20th floor, we saw Josephine Harris standing in the doorway, and she was crying. And my guy stopped, and one of my firefighters, Tommy Falco, turned around to me and said, hey, Cap, what do you want to do with her? And it was, how can I put this? Every fiber in my being was screaming at me to get out of this building. Every second that we waste was 1 second closer to us not getting out of the building. But that's not what firemen do. We were there to save people's lives. That's the whole purpose of for us climbing those stairs, was to save someone. And that culture, that firefighter culture, overtook whatever personal need I felt to get out of the building. And I said, okay, let's stop and we'll save this woman. And it seems like it was a monumental decision at the time, but there was a true spirit of altruism within the building. And, it was the right thing to do. There was a lot of other firemen who were in that building who were doing similar things to what we were doing.
So since she had such trouble walking, how were you trying to get her down the stairs?
We took her arm, one of her arms, and put it around one of my firefighters' shoulders and Billy Butler's shoulders. And all the other firefighters in my company took some of Billy's tools and equipment, and we were actually carrying her down the stairs, hoisting her, that way. It wasn't until we got to the fourth floor was when she couldn't even support her own weight anymore. She fell to the floor and she started yelling at us to leave her. That's when I decided to break into the fourth floor to look for a sturdy chair that we could have put her on, and we can pick her up with her in the chair and we could run with her. And fourth floor was not an office floor, so it didn't have any chairs. So I was way on the other side of the building when I just thought to myself, well, we're just going to have to drag her down the stairs. And I started running back to the stairway.
At what point did the building start collapsing?
Just before I made it back to the stairway on the fourth floor, that's when the collapse of the North Tower started. So I dove for the stairway, and I just covered up as best I could.
So you made it into the stairway?
I made it into the stairway. I made it to the landing of the fourth floor.
Can you explain how in the world you managed to survive when the North Tower collapsed on top of you? You were on the fourth floor.
The only thing that I can offer as an explanation is that the two buildings collapsed in two different ways. The South Tower collapsed differently than the North Tower. The South Tower collapsed, it kind of leaned over first, and then it collapsed because the way the plane hit it, it created a plane of weakness, similar to the way you would cut a piece of sheetrock or something like that. The North Tower collapsed the way it was designed to. It actually collapsed in what's called a pancake fashion. And the building actually just kind of peels away, similar to the way you would peel a banana. And we were the banana. We were in the geographic center of that building. And everything just kind of fell outward and down. If you were a little higher than I was, the stairway was intact up to the fifth floor. So you would survive if you were up on the fifth floor. But if you were on the ground floor, you wouldn't survive because that the weight of everything coming down would have crushed you. So you kind of had to be where we were, you know, somewhere between the first floor and the fifth floor.
Could you just describe what you experienced as the tower collapsed on top of you?
Well, it started out, the floor started to move. And since the collapse started about 1,300 feet away, the sound was off in the distance, and it got louder as it got closer. And you could hear the floors hitting the other floors, and every time that happened, it created tremendous vibration in the stairway. And you could also hear the sound of twisting steel all around you. And it got louder as the collapse got closer, and the vibration got more violent as it got closer as well.
Were you shocked that you were alive after the collapse was over?
Yeah, my first thought was that that I didn't get my men out, that I had failed them. And I just covered up as best I could and hoped for the best. And then the collapse stopped. And we were coughing and gagging, trying to get pieces of debris out of our mouths, our noses, our eyes. And my first thought was, all right, I wonder who else is still alive. And I gave out a roll call, and my all my people were accounted for. And we had a, I didn't know Josephine's name at the time. I said, what about the woman? I said, yeah, the woman's still here. She's alive. So our initial thought was, okay, we're alive. Let's dust ourselves off and continue down the stairway. And word came quickly from down below that we couldn't get out from down below. So that's when we started our survival mode, I guess.
How did you get out?
Eventually, like about 4 hours later, the smoke and dust cleared enough outside where all of a sudden some sunshine started to hit the stairway where we were. And all of a sudden I could see a pencil with beam of sunlight hit the stairway. And I looked up and I see a little sliver of blue sky. And we were in the dark most of the time. So all of a sudden I realized that there used to be 106 floors over our heads and now I see blue sky. I said, well, we're on top of the World Trade Center.
Oh, wow. You mean you're saying that, but at this point the fourth floor was like the top floor because everything had collapsed beneath you?
Yeah. And it was at that point that we were able to, with the additional light, that we were able to figure out that we could breach a hole in the rubble and work our way out.
So you climbed out through what had become the top of the World Trade Center?
Yeah, the fourth floor at this point. Because the rubble pile at that point was about four stories tall, about 40 feet high. So we essentially went out sideways and then down a little bit. And then the rubble was very uneven, you know. So, but right at that point, right where the B stairway was, it was about 4 or 5 stories tall.
So when you escaped the collapsed Tower of the World Trade Center, did you allow yourself to experience the elation of surviving, or was your heart too heavy knowing about how many people had not gotten out of those towers?
Well, my first thought once I exited the rubble and I actually saw what it looked like outside, we really didn't know what it looked like outside. You know, just we're trying to get a visual from talking to different people over the radio. But once I saw the complete devastation, my first thought was, oh, my God, I can't believe that I survived this. And you want to be happy, but you know you can't. You know, later in the day when I was being treated at an ambulance, one of my guys was talking to me. Tommy Falco was talking to me. He says, hey, Cap, how many guys do you think we lost here today? And I stopped and I thought about it, and I looked around. I said, oh, Tommy, I don't know. maybe a couple hundred. And then I caught myself when I said that. I said, what the heck did I just say? I said, prior to that day, our biggest life loss was in 1966. We lost 12 firemen in the 23rd Street collapse. And I just said the words a couple hundred. And it turns out I was off by almost double, you know. It was hard to feel any sense of joy or accomplishments or anything like that. That looking out and knowing how much pain and grief that's going to be going on out there. Soon after I spoke to Tommy Falco, one of the there was a guy who was one of my contemporaries, Jimmy Ritchies, came up to me, and he said, "Jay, I heard your radio transmissions. Congratulations." He says, "That was unbelievable. That was one of the most dramatic things I've ever heard." I said, "Oh, thanks. It's good to be out." And then he said, "By the way, did you see Engine 4 today?" And I thought to myself, "Jeeves, what an odd question." And I thought about it, and I said, no, I can honestly say I didn't see Engine 4 today. And he said, "Oh." He said, "My son was working in Engine 4 today." And that hit me like a ton of bricks, that this is going to be monumental, the amount of grief and suffering. You know, you had so many father and son and brothers within the fire department, that this is going to be monumental in scope as far as grief and bereavement.
You say in the book that you don't like it when people say to you, "You survived because God was with you." Why don't you like it when people say that?
Well, first of all, it's a little pompous to say that you were a miracle, you know. But second of all, by them saying that God was with me that day, you're also kind of saying that God was not with them that day. And that's certainly not the case. You know, I think of the one radio transmission between Chief Pete Hayden and Captain Patty Brown. Chief Hayden's talking to him as we're coming down the stairs, and I'm hearing this over the radio. Pete Hayden is calling Captain Patty Brown on the radio. It says, "Command post to Ladder 3. Get out of the building. Get out of the building." And Patty Brown gets on the radio and he says, "I refuse the order," which is unbelievable, you know, that somebody would say that. He says, "I refuse the order. I'm up here on the 44th floor, and I got too many burnt people with me. I'm not leaving them." You know, it still sends shivers up my spine hearing that. And
I take it he did not survive.
No. Patty Brown, all the men from Ladder 3, and all the people that they were treating all died in the collapse.
You say in the book that whenever you go to work, you always have in the back of your mind the possibility that this could be the last day of your life. Why have you continued to do the work that you do and put yourself in the position of experiencing that kind of possibility every working day?
Well, it's hard not to feel that way after seeing all the death and destruction down there, that this could happen again. And it's hard not to feel that way, but I wanted to be a fireman my whole life, and I'm doing something that I want to do, and I'm very happy to still be doing it. So I don't want to have somebody chase me away from something that I love to do.
Did your family ask you to give up the work after September 11th?
No, they never did. My children went through different bouts of anxiety with it, but no, they never did ask me to leave.
You were on medical leave for a while afterwards. What were the problems that you were having?
I was on medical leave for a month. I actually went full duty on October 11th, and my eyes were injured. I had a twisted ankle. My breathing wasn't the best. And, you know, just the high levels of stress and anxiety, that they just says, you know, you could stay out as long as you want. I says, well, how long does it take for the adrenaline to leave your system after something like this? He said, about a month. And I said, all right, I'll take the month.
And that was enough?
Well, yeah, and I got promoted to battalion chief 5 days after September 11th, So all my comfort zone was now gone. So I no longer had my own firehouse again. I had a different rank. I had different responsibilities. So all during that time, I was stressing out what I was going to do when I went back to work. And my first tour in, I was driving to Coney Island. And I had my first fire that night after September 11th. And once I went to the fire, all the anxiety was gone, all the stress was gone. That I felt most at ease, you know, during a fire.
Like you knew what to do and all of your automatic responses just kicked in.
Well, it's something that we've trained our whole adult lives to do, and it's something that we do very well. And, you know, went to the fire. It was a fire in a high-rise housing project, and the fire went out. Nobody got hurt. And it was just something in the back of my mind. I says, you know what, this is going to be okay. We'll survive this.
Jay Jonas is a deputy chief in the New York City Fire Department. He's one of the people profiled in the new book, A Decade of Hope. You'll find a longer version of Terry's conversation with Jonas, which includes a discussion with Dennis Smith, the retired firefighter who wrote A Decade of Hope, on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Of all the subjects a first-time novelist might attempt, America in the Wake of September 11th would seem a really unwise choice. It's too ambitious, too fraught, just too much. Fortunately, says book critic Maureen Corrigan, Amy Waldman didn't get that memo. Waldman served as co-chief of the South Asia Bureau of the New York Times, and her short fiction has been published in The Atlantic. Her debut novel about September 11th is called The Submission, and Maureen says it's a triumph.
The Submission is a gorgeously written novel of ideas about America in the wake of September 11th. It tackles touchy subjects like identity politics, undocumented immigrants, and the stress fractures of democracy. Maybe the most audacious question that's posed by Amy Waldman's debut novel, however, is the implicit one that lingers long after a reader finishes it, namely, could it be that a decade after the attacks, America finally has the 9/11 novel, one that does justice, artistically and historically, to the aftershocks of that day? Of course, there have been other serious fiction contenders that have ruminated on September 11th, among them Joseph O'Neill's Netherland, Deborah Eisenberg's short story collection, Twilight of the Superheroes, Don DeLillo's Falling Man, and Ken Kalfas's Dark Tour de Force, a disorder peculiar to the country. But The Submission distinguishes itself by its panoramic scope and also by the ease with which it pulls off the literary magic trick of being at once poetic and polemical. Arguments about America are hashed out relentlessly on the pages of this novel, and yet Waldman never stints on character development, plot, or the pleasures of her inventive language. Ever the English teacher, I even found myself making lists of all the startling verbs and metaphors Waldman comes up with. For instance, describing a tough woman laughing meanly at another's expense, Waldman writes, "Her laugh burst forth, breaking up her face like jackhammered cement." This is an assured, ambitious novel that appeals to both a reader's senses and intelligence. The central situation here will sound more contrived in my summary than it is in Waldman's execution. Here goes. 2 years after the attacks, a jury of artists, academics, and one non-credentialed civilian, a 9/11 widow, has been convened to sift through some 5,000 blind design entries for a memorial at the site of Ground Zero. In the opening chapter, a winner is chosen. And then the dumbfounded jury learns that their pick is a Muslim American architect named Mohammed Khan. The chief champion of Khan's design was the 9/11 widow, Claire Burwell. Waldman succinctly characterizes Claire's grief for her late husband this way. It had been 2 years. He appeared in her dreams, but vanished on waking. and she spoke of him in qualities, positive, ebullient, smart, principled, that had no texture. Claire initially loves the design for a rectangular walled garden as a memorial, especially the fact that it would be composed of both life-affirming greenery as well as steel trees made out of salvaged scraps from the World Trade Center. But as soon as Kahn's name is leaked to the public, controversy rages about the identity of the architect and his garden design. It seems Islamic to some critics. In fact, Lou Sarge, a Rush Limbaugh-like radio personality, charges that the garden is Mohammed Khan's sly strategy to construct an Islamic martyr's paradise on Ground Zero. Claire finds herself pressured to rethink her support for the garden. At a raucous public hearing in New York, one bereaved father poignantly states his objections. "We who have carried the weight of loss are now being asked to carry the weight of proving America's tolerance." Kahn himself is an aloof guy who doesn't play well to the media. He's outraged that, as an American, he should even be called upon to justify his patriotism. As more and more voices pile into the national debate, the arguments become more complicated. A scholar opines that the World Trade Center towers themselves contained Islamic architectural features. Another 9/11 widow speaks out to ask if there will even be a place for her husband's name on whatever memorial will be built, given that he was one of the many undocumented immigrants who worked at the towers, cleaning bathrooms and hallways. The submission is sure to generate a lot of discussion in book clubs across the land about the promises of democracy. In so doing, Waldman's novel itself serves as a powerful memorial to 9/11 and the struggles of America in its aftermath.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Amy Waldman's novel, The Submission. 10 years later, how have 9/11 and its repercussions changed our language? Not as much as people expected, says our linguist Jeff Nunberg.
They were instant cliches, but they needed saying anyway. September 11th was our Pearl Harbor. It would change the way we think and create a new normal. It defined a generation. And from the beginning, people looked to the language to bear witness to how utterly differently we were seeing the world. 10 years later, it's not so clear. I've been making a list of all the words I've been tracking since 2001 that were connected to 9/11 and its repercussions. It's a jumble: Axis of Evil and the Army You Have, Cakewalk, Coalition of the Willing and Connect the Dots, Dead or Alive and Don't Touch My Junk, Evildoers and Enhanced Interrogation. But the one thing that jumps out at me is how ephemeral they are. Most have already disappeared. And apart from 9/11 itself, few of the rest will be around a decade from now. Of course, buzzwords come and go, but it's striking that 9/11 and its after effects have left almost no traces in the language of everyday life. Shortly after the attacks, the Washington Post reported that teenagers were calling a punishment a jihad and describing hot salsa as weapons grade. I'm dubious, to put it mildly, but if anybody ever did use those words, they didn't catch on. Nor did we pick up on any of the pungent slang of the soldiers serving in war zones, like embrace the suck for deal with it, or Casper for a gold bricker who disappears when there's work to be done. That's the big linguistic difference between 9/11 and World War II. That war left a vast legacy in the American vocabulary. Beachhead, blitz, blockbuster, and bloodbath, Boondocks, Blackout, and Brown Nose, just to name some of the B's. I know, it's not a fair comparison. In World War II, just about every family had someone in the service, and the war affected the lives of everybody on the home front, the rationing and scrap metal drives, the women pouring into the workforce, the families pulling out their world atlases to listen to the news on the radio. Yet even Vietnam contributed more items to the language than 9/11 has, including some that were recycled over the last decade, like hawks and doves, stay the course, and light at the end of the tunnel. But wars could only have that kind of broad effect on the language when they reached so deeply into the life of a people that they created a common point of reference. At that point, it felt natural to use military words like blockbuster, beachhead, and flak as metaphors for everyday experience. That didn't happen here. In those first days, Americans were desperate to do something to help. People drove across the country to lend a hand at Ground Zero, lined up to give blood, collected food and clothing. It was heartwarming, but as it turned out, it wasn't really necessary. This war wasn't going to have much of a home front. In fact, if you were lucky enough not to be one of the few people whose lives were devastated, then by the weird logic of terrorism, you could be most helpful by not doing anything different at all. The patriotic thing to do, the president told us, was just to go to Disney World as planned. I think of that absurd but telling phrase that appeared just after the attacks: if we cancel the party or don't send the marching band to the Rose Bowl, then the terrorists win. Everybody knew it was a rationalization. Al-Qaeda weren't gnashing their teeth at the thought that Ellen DeGeneres would be hosting the Emmys as scheduled. And by November, the phrase was a joke. The New Yorker ran a cartoon by J.C. Duffy that showed a man in a bar saying, "I figure if I don't have that third martini, then the terrorists win." Yet people kept using the phrase anyway. It helped them or their customers square their consciences, as it became clear that in the period that followed this new Pearl Harbor, only a few people would be called on to do the serious sacrificing. For the rest of us, the actual hardship would chiefly extend to having to leave for the airport an hour earlier. Even after the dissipation of that sense of common purpose, people didn't tune everything out. We were still anxious and concerned, both about terrorism and about the war on it, even if now they were a focus of contention more often than unity. And we were all grateful to the 5 or 10% of Americans, civilian and military, who had chosen to put 9/11 and its consequences at the center of their lives. Though now, of course, supporting the troops was less arduous than it was in World War II, when it involved giving up some Saturdays. But when the dust cleared, 9/11 was no longer uppermost in our thoughts. When the American Dialect Society voted on the word of the decade in 2010, 9/11 came in a distant third behind Google and blog. It's hard to argue with that ranking. The internet has gotten a lot more of our attention than 9/11 over the last 10 years, and it's given us a lot more new words. If there's any difference between the new normal and the old, you couldn't tell it from the way we talk.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. Earlier this week, the members of the Air Force Clarinet Quartet, the Bay State Winds, spoke with Terry Gross and recorded a musical tribute to the men and women who've served our nation. This excerpt from their visit begins with their performance of the song "America the Beautiful."
Oh, that was really great. That's America the Beautiful, performed for us by members of the Bay State Winds, which is the clarinet quartet of the U.S. Air Force Band of Liberty. Now, when I saw you at the Noontime Concert at King's Chapel in Boston last month, you closed with a medley of the four armed forces themes. And you suggested that each person in the audience who had served in the military stand when their theme was played. And for each theme, at least one person stood and saluted. And I have to say it was very moving, in part because it made me realize that, for instance, the guy in front of me had probably been through some pretty rough stuff. And I wouldn't have known that. I wouldn't have thought of that. And it made me think of all the people I run into in the course of a day or in the course of a week who have been in war zones, and of all the families with loved ones who are or have been in war zones. And when you meet them, you don't necessarily know that, and you don't know what they or their loved one has been through. Can you talk about the significance of playing this medley for you now?
I will say any time that we perform this piece, I'm always looking at the audience and just to see if I can find someone who is maybe crying, or let's say some people have like difficulty standing up or something, but when they hear their service song, they definitely do whatever they can just to stand up. Now, something else we do in this with this piece, the Salute to the Armed Services, is that we not only extend this to the service members, we also do it for the families too.
Okay, well, great. So this is the Bay State Winds, which is the clarinet quartet of the U.S. Air Force Band of Liberty, performing for us a medley of the Armed Forces themes.
That's the Bay State Winds Clarinet Quartet performing a medley of the Armed Forces themes. You can hear more of their performance and conversation with Terry Gross on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.